I'm Lauren Layfield, and you're listening to Your Next Podcast. This is the podcast that brings you a different series every single week, helping you to find your new favorite show. Today, we're listening to a brand new podcast called The World. It's from Sky News and NBC and hosted by two of their best international reporters, Yalda Higim and Richard Engel. Every week, the two will be talking about the biggest stories in world news. Now, Richard tends to actually find himself wherever the action is happening, and he reports from the ground, whilst Yalda's contact book means she always knows the right person to speak to about any given issue. So this episode is super fresh, obviously, because it's the news. So I hope you really enjoy it. This is The World with Richard Engel and Yalda Higim.
Hello, and welcome to the first ever podcast of The World with me, Richard Engel, NBC News' chief foreign correspondent.
And me, Yalda Higim, Sky News' lead world news presenter.
This is, as I said, the first episode of our podcast, and we will take you with us as we report from the front lines of conflicts around the world.
And Richard, we do get to the front lines of the world, and we know how important it is to cover these stories because what happens somewhere else impacts people everywhere.
So we will try and break through all the noise and chaos and make some sense of this very often scary world.
Make sure you follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode.
You should also know you can watch us on our dedicated YouTube channel. Just search YouTube for The World with Richard Engel and Yalda Higim, and we're available on Spotify.
And in this episode, we're going to be talking about Richard's experiences in Lebanon and mine here in Israel. We're also going to be talking about whether things are going to escalate here in this region and whether anyone can stop this from escalating.
Well, there's a lot to talk about, so let's dive in.
Richard, tell me where you are right now.
So I am in Beirut, Lebanon, and I was just in southern Lebanon in the city of Tyre, which is part, Tyre itself hasn't been ordered, evacuated by the Israelis, but almost everything around it has. And I was down there for a week and I just pulled into Beirut a few moments ago. And obviously we're all here in the region because it was a year ago, almost exactly, that the October 7th attack happened when Hamas militants broke out of Gaza, went on a killing and kidnapping spree, and it changed the dynamics of the Middle East. Netanyahu's government went on the warpath, and it is only escalating now.
I'm currently in Jerusalem, Richard, but I was at the site of the Nova Music Festival, which is now being described as the bloodiest music festival in history. That is one of the places that Hamas tore through. They arrived, 3,000 people were partying at about 6:30 in the morning on October the 7th. They killed 364 people and they took about 44 hostages back to Gaza. There's still 97 hostages that we know of that have been held in Gaza after the initial 250 that they took. And 1,200 people that they killed on that day. And it changed Israel. It changed the lives of the Palestinians. And you can still feel the grief, the pain, the agony of the Israeli people. They tell me that it feels like one long day since October the 7th. And while I was there, Richard, you know, I was 3 miles from Gaza and we could hear the outgoing artillery fire into Gaza every few minutes. I timed it. Every minute and a half, there was a louder sort of bang, and the helicopters overhead, the ongoing sound of drones, it was just, you know, exhausting to hear and to know what was happening in Gaza, but also to really get a sense of just the turmoil that this country continues to be in.
So we know why we're here. You are in Jerusalem. I'm in Beirut, having just come from the south. I think the situation is spiraling into a corkscrew into an abyss. It just keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper. and you are seeing the Israelis just furious, stuck in a perpetual state of their 9/11. So let's talk about today, not so much how we got here, where we are now, and where we're going. Where do you think this is heading?
I was at the October 7th memorial. It was small, but it was very a sort of a somber, emotional day. You know, every now and then, between all the prayers, you could hear a mother just wailing, suddenly screaming, and then silence, and then the artillery fire. This was the weird thing about being in this place. But there were about 360 or 370 images of the people, the young people who were killed. Very different to Tel Aviv and Hostage Square, which you have been to many times as well, where we see these images on the large screens, you know, scrolling of the pictures of those who have been taken. This was just stills, almost like tombstones that were created with flowers and sort of flags, Israeli flags.
I've seen these are like posters, like giant posters on easels.
Exactly. And of the people who were killed and the hostages, some who are still alive, some who are dead or missing, or they're not sure whether they are in Gaza or not. So there's still a lot of uncertainty.
And a lot of anger and a lot of victimization and justification. And that's one of the biggest things that I've noticed about this conflict. And it's no obvious thing to say that in conflicts, people, you know, don't get along, right? That sounds almost comically stupid. Of course, people don't get along in conflicts and don't see eye to eye. Otherwise, they wouldn't be fighting each other. But in this one, it's different. Here, when you're in Israel or talking to Israelis in this current moment, they feel completely justified in their position. They feel they have no other choice, that this is a war of self-defense. It's a war of survival. It's an existential struggle. And that Jewish people, you know, going back to thousands of years, let alone the modern history of the Holocaust, that they've gone through too much, they've been through too many rough times, and they're not going to take it anymore, and they need to get tough, and these people in the region have poked them, and it's time for Israel to lay down the law. Is that sort of how you, that was the impression I've consistently
got? Yeah, no, absolutely. It was very much enough is enough. You know, we could hear the artillery fire and they were saying, you don't come here, you don't cause what is the worst day in Israel's history and get away with it. And so this sense on both sides, as you say, this visceral hatred for what the other side has done.
When you're here in Lebanon, or many parts of the Arab world, it's the opposite. You don't get the Israeli perspective at all. You don't understand what they're talking about. It seems like they're the bullies and people here are on the receiving end, and that Israel and the United States are just pushing everyone around to redefine the new global order, certainly in the Middle East, and Netanyahu to save himself. And there is a sense of victimization here that is profound.
Richard, I'll give you one story of a father that I met, and he was one of the organizers of the memorial. His son hid in a dumpster, a massive yellow container under rubbish at this music festival for 5 hours waiting for the military to arrive. Don't forget, this is also one of Israel's biggest security failure as well. They pride themselves on their sophisticated security surveillance defense. And yet for 5 or 6 hours, in some communities, 12 hours, the IDF didn't show up. But this father tells me his son called him from the dumpster. He was there with 16 other people. He said, we're hiding under rubbish. We've sent our location to the IDF. We're going to be okay. They're coming to get us. We're fine. After 5 hours, he said that one of the Hamas guys opened the dumpster and shot every single person that he could see in that dumpster. And his son, Ron, was killed inside that dumpster alongside 9 others. Four others were injured, and 3 others weren't, they were left unharmed. But just gives you a sense of, you know, and his father was describing the story to me you know, we both have children. It's hard to understand that kind of loss. But the way that his father was describing his loss to me was like it happened just moments ago. And so when you feel that kind of pain and anger, you know, on both sides.
And for the Jewish people, this does bring up so many terrible memories of Jews hiding in ghettos, hiding from the Gestapo, being, you know, machine gunned down and pushed into trenches. I get that visceral reaction when Israel was founded on this principle, never again, and then suddenly people just across their Gaza border are coming in and doing atrocities. But here, this dichotomy is so different. So I just came back from the South, and we'll get to the South in a minute. So I was just pulling into Beirut. And Yelda, you were here a few days ago.
I was, 4 days ago.
So most of the Israeli bombings in Beirut anyway are focused in the Dahiya neighborhood in the South suburb, which is kind of a Hezbollah stronghold, a Shia stronghold in general. So not everybody in there is Hezbollah, but Hezbollah is there, runs the show there, and many, many Shia families live around in the it's the most densely populated part of the city. And a lot of people have left. But as I was pulling into Beirut, I saw all these families just from Dahiya, displaced people, in tents, sleeping by the side of the road. It's pretty early here right now, so they were just sort of waking up. I saw naked children being bathed by their mothers and fathers, totally naked, just standing by the side of the road in trash. And it left me one of these impressions, like, where are we as a society? And when you watch the television here, there's a split screen. So you have one screen showing Gaza and the ongoing campaign in Gaza. You have one screen showing Beirut and the constant bombing in South Beirut. You have another part of the screen, you know, they're broken up into little boxes, showing the Bekaa Valley and other parts of Lebanon, they're being attacked. And there is a sense of victimhood here, that Lebanon is being victimized by Israel. And there's almost no discussion of October 7th. There's no discussion of any kind of victims on the Israeli side. No mention of that family in the yellow dumpster.
It's just to give people a perspective, for anyone who hasn't been to Beirut, it is a modern, you know, trilingual a city full of educated people. You know, you could be anywhere in the world. You could be in New York. You could be in Tel Aviv. You could be in London. You know, Beirut is an incredibly cool, young, modern city.
But it's broken right now, Yelda. It's in such bad shape. And there's been this long dynamic where, yes, Beirut looks great on the surface. The people are attractive. The food is great. There's beaches. Have some brutalist and a little bit of modern architecture. There's some traditional architecture, but not much left. But it's always been a city that is, through the harshest of times, still found a way to smile and keep going. And sort of the joie de vivre here is quite high. But I can tell you, this place really right now is very worried. Hezbollah has taken a beating. Their leadership has been decapitated. They're being attacked by Israel. People are displaced. And now, because of the changing power dynamics, they're worried it's going to throw them into a new round of civil war.
You know, just to give context, and you know this, Richard, in those first few days that I was there and Israel launched, you know, its aerial bombardment campaign on Lebanon, in the 2006 war, as you know, 1,000 people died in the space of 30 days. In the space of 4 days, we'd already gotten to 800 people. The authorities there are now saying the death toll is well over 2,000. And a fifth of the population, 1 million people, are on the move. They've been displaced. I mean, you would have seen a lot of them, you know, moving and the way that you're describing what's happening in Beirut.
Oh, you should see the South. So I was in Tyre with my team. And the city is effectively empty. You drive around, there's more and more damage every day. Very few civilians left. Everyone's gone. Everyone is left. And they're worried about Gaza. They're worried that this place is going to be erased from the map and collapse into civil war.
you know, the war in Gaza has left 41,000 people dead, 97,000 people injured as a result of the ongoing bombardment. That I was looking at images of Gaza just yesterday, and the whole place is flattened and under rubble. So this region, very much the Arab world, places like Lebanon, groups like Hezbollah, feel tied to what is happening in Gaza. And of course, while I was with you, you know, in Lebanon just last week, we saw Iran launch 200 ballistic missiles, you know, on Israel.
I saw that happen. We could see a lot of that actually taking place from southern Lebanon, because southern Lebanon is close to the Israeli border. A lot of those ballistic missiles flew through Lebanese airspace on their way to northern Israel. So a lot of that sound and light show that you saw of the ballistic missiles heading toward Israel and the counterfire from the Israeli air defense systems, the American air defense systems, was happening right over our heads at extremely high altitudes, because these ballistic missiles almost fly into space and then to come back down. But it was all happening over our heads. And then we're all waiting to see what happens with, you know, with Iran. Which brings me to my next point. Do you think that people there in Israel buy this philosophy, this vision that Netanyahu has been selling to the world, that he has a new vision for the Middle East? The new vision for the Middle East is just get rid of Iran's proxies, tame Iran, if not get rid of the Iranian regime, but certainly knock it back a few steps. Then this new Middle East will sort of rise up. Just take the weeds out and all the flowers are going to bloom in this new Middle East that is led apparently by Israel, Emirates, Saudi. But do people there in Israel seem to be on board with this project? Do they buy it?
You know, Richard, his popularity, it's been extraordinary to watch. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, is a survivor, and he seems to land on his feet every single time. The way that the war in Gaza was prosecuted, he found himself and this nation isolated. The international community, it divided the international community, the Western world. And in terms of where this nation now is, having seen the way that their security establishment and the IDF have, in their views, you know, decapitated Hezbollah and dealt a massive blow to this enemy in their north, they now are buying into this project. They don't believe this will lead to some kind of World War III. They don't think it's going to disrupt the world order. They think by smashing Iran, by cutting it down, you know, you're going to reshape this region, which they feel is long overdue. You know, they feel this, as you say, this existential threat that they are surrounded by nations who don't want them there. So ultimately, if you do have friendly Arab nations like the Gulf states, like the you know, Emiratis, for example, they've signed a normalization deals with them under President Trump. They do feel that they can have that kind of relationship with countries in this region.
Look, I get the feeling and I get the sentiment, and it's not that a lot of people have been delighted about Hezbollah or Hamas or the Houthis or Iran's other proxies in the Shia militias in Iraq, the Shia militias in Syria. There are a lot of people in the Middle East who will be happy to see the backs of these groups, no doubt. But the problem is the Israeli plan seems really thin on details. It seems emotional. We're going to smash Iran. We're going to smash Hezbollah. We're going to smash Gaza. We're going to hit the Houthis. We're going to hit the militias in Iraq. And then what? Everything is just going to be great. It's all just going to fall into order magically. It doesn't seem like there's a step-by-step plan here as opposed to an ideology.
This is their 9/11 moment. They now see a window of opportunity to eliminate all their enemies. But it, you know, just as we saw after 9/11 and after the invasion of Afghanistan and then Iraq, we saw President Bush stand there and say, mission accomplished, and then find themselves stuck in a 20-year war, you know, unable to get out effectively, replace the Taliban with the Taliban with a 20-year gap in between. And they always maintained, we are not here to nation build. We're not here, you know, to sort of do anything other than fight terrorism. And it feels very much for the Israelis, it's a very similar situation. Well, let's take a little break and we'll be back with you in a moment.
Welcome back. And this is just a reminder, if anyone wants to reach out with us, they have a question about something that they want explained or more information about or our take on, please, you can and should write to us. And here's the address, The World, all together, theworld@sky.uk. And we will read as many as we can and try and get back to you in the very next show.
We are now 4 weeks away from the US election. And President Biden's legacy, I mean, it's in his attempt and quest for peace throughout this year. What he has done is by not being more firm, by not putting the kind of pressure that was expected, the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, he said to me, friends come and give you a bear hug in your time of pain and grief, which Biden did. But they also, you know, talk tough when you need to have that kind of conversation. And he said to me at the time, I wish he would take Benjamin Netanyahu into a room, preferably with a baseball bat, and show him what American power and pressure and influence looks like.
Yeah, did you see the article? It was an editorial by in the New York Times, Nick Kristof, said that Bibi Netanyahu has been running circles around President Biden and the administration from the start.
He has essentially humiliated President Biden, his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who has made a dozen trips to the region, begging and pleading and asking and trying to put pressure behind closed doors.
The Biden administration from the beginning has been trying to push on the door and pull the door at the same time, telling Israel to, you know, slow down, but we're going to send you more weapons and we need to respect civilian casualties, but Israel has unlimited support. So they're sending these crazy mixed messages. I never thought this diplomacy was going to go anywhere because it didn't make any sense. What is the U.S. position on this?
And today, we have exactly what the Biden administration and Antony Blinken said they didn't want happening. They didn't want this to escalate and spill over to other parts of the region.
Oh, worse than that, they're still pretending there's not a regional war. They keep saying, we don't want this to escalate and become a regional war. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's all, how many more regional do you want it to get?
And if the Americans think that they're somehow not going to get dragged into this, you know, if the Iranians start launching through their proxies, you know, through their allies, through this axis of resistance, start launching attacks on American bases, Gulf bases, or, you know, the ones in Iraq and other places, they are going to get dragged into this conflict. If they think that somehow they can just let this bubble along, you know, and somehow it's going to sort itself out, clearly they don't understand the complexities of this region.
How do you think this plays out between now and Election Day? And I actually think the real turning point isn't necessarily Election Day, it's inauguration. But how do you see this moving based on the U.S. timeline?
I think that if Kamala Harris wins this election, it will be a continuation, as far as Benjamin Netanyahu is concerned, of how he has behaved under the Biden administration. It is not going to change. That piece that you talked about in the New York Times, where, you know, he described running rings around President Biden, I think he's going to do that, and perhaps in a greater way under Kamala Harris. We're still unclear of exactly what her policies are, what she stands for. You know, she seems to be very thin on explaining exactly who and what she is and what her administration would look like. The question is, Richard, if a Donald Trump gets reelected and we have a Trump 2.0, what does that look like? Now, some people say the situation could get worse on the ground. You know, I'm not sure, because Donald Trump is so incredibly unpredictable. You know, he left his adversaries and America's allies last time guessing constantly. He is a man who knows how to speak thug.
They call it the madman theory of foreign politics.
Yeah, I mean, he knows how to use power.
Nixon tried it for a little while. It's like, I'm so crazy don't trust me, don't put me in a corner because I'm capable of doing anything. And therefore, you better get in line. It's an approach.
It is, and it's his approach. It is unnerving. And it's, you know, and I've had people who say to me, if Donald Trump gets reelected, we're screwed. If Kamala Harris gets reelected, we're screwed. So it will be interesting, I think, to see how Donald Trump plays this out. Will he pick up the phone? Like he said numerous times, the war in the Middle East wouldn't happen if I was in power. You know, the war in Ukraine would end within 24 hours if I was in power. The way that Afghanistan collapsed wouldn't have happened if I was in power. Who knows?
I'm just looking structurally. If you look structurally, we've got a power vacuum in the United States, unlike any that I can imagine. Now you have this bitter, very tense electoral race that's going to go right down to the wire, as they all do, but right down to the wire in that first week in November. Then the question is, what happens then? And I think no matter what happens, we're going to have turmoil in the United States between the election and inauguration. If he wins, he'll start governing right away because that's his style. And he's already said he's going to do that. He said he was going to solve the Ukraine crisis probably before he even came into power. So, okay, let's say he wins on November 6th, November 7th is clear. Okay. And then he starts making policy. And he's saying, the Ukrainians don't need any more weapons. They've had enough. They should have a peace deal or Gaza. He's signaling how he wants that to end. That's not policy at this stage. So you're going to have the White House at the podium saying, no, we stand firmly with the Ukrainian people, or we don't want this to happen to Gaza, or whatever the contradiction is. So there's going to be chaos until inauguration as Trump is saying what he wants to do, governing from the sidelines. That's if he wins. If she wins, it's already clear, if you look at what all the people are saying in the House, that it's going to be a contested result, or it's very likely to be a contested result in the courts, and it's going to go down to the wire at least until January with back and forth. So it means, I'm estimating that there's going to be a vacuum of power, some sort of chaos, at the very least until inauguration, January 20th, if not beyond.
The fact that when America starts to, you know, become inward looking, and it will, especially, you know, as we sort of get to the point of the election and beyond. And if you think, you know, the kind of chaos that you're describing, as you say, it provides a window and a vacuum for these other states to do as they please. You know, we've seen the limitations of American power through the course of this year. Even if America goes into a state of chaos, I'm not sure how much worse the situation can get for this region. Whether that's going to lead to a greater sort of war beyond this region, I'm not sure. I remain optimistic and hopeful that it doesn't sort of turn into World War III. Whatever happens, as devastating as it is for this region, it is contained within this region.
And well, speaking of, do you consider Iran in this region? I guess
yes.
I think I do. I mean, it's not Sunni, it's not Arab, it's next to Afghanistan. It's just sort of on the edges of the region, and that's a big part of all of this. And I've been trying to spend all week trying to, since the Iranian missile strike and that fireworks show over my head and tire, I've been trying to think when the Israelis are going to strike back, how they're going to strike back. Are they going to hit the oil industry? Are they going to hit the nuclear facilities? By the way, if they hit the oil industry, it has a huge impact on the U.S. election. You know, they hit the oil industry. Some analysts have said there's an immediate shock of like $20 a barrel. Gas prices go up. A few weeks before the election, suddenly gas prices are up. That's not good for Harris. It helps Trump. He can say, look at the chaos here. I would fix all of this. So there are real consequences of what might happen for an Israeli reprisal.
There will be some in the United States who think, yeah, you know, go in, smash Iran, cut them down, and reshape this region. But as you say, that is that feels very much like a very simplistic, naive approach to resolving what feels at this point so deep and unresolvable in this moment.
What's happening now, we're not going to know the impact of for years, if not decades to come. If the Israelis do hit a nuclear site, which may or may not do, and there's different speculation about that, that has huge consequences because it either stops the nuclear program or sets it back if it's successful. From Israel's point of view, or it's a strong warning, but just forces Iran to make its program even more hidden, bury it deeper underground, rush out toward a bomb. So there are consequences to that. Gaza is not over, and you can't destroy an enormous area, make 2.2 million people homeless and constantly under attack without that blowing back. So I think this, what's happening now, if it doesn't lead to World War III, you know, nuclear bombs of Russia and China and everyone getting involved, it's certainly setting up for a protracted, much longer and much more bitter conflict in the region for, I would say, a decade or more.
Yeah, absolutely. An incredibly dangerous moment.
We said we were going to make them feel better about the world in this podcast. We didn't promise good news. We promised that we would try and pick some subjects apart. So in our first episode, did we succeed? Did we make people feel more comfortable in understanding the world, or does it make it just seem even more horrible than they already thought?
We get out, we spend time with people in the field, we talk to officials, we try and hold those people in positions of power accountable. We talk to those who have been affected and impacted by these conflicts and upheaval and turmoil. So I hope people, you know, through our experiences and what we see and hear, will get a better sense of their world.
So come on in every Wednesday. Please continue to join us. We will give you a front row seat. I like to consider this job, and I've always said this, Yalda, I've said this to you before, that I think of journalism as having a front row seat on the train of history. So come on, get on the train with us. The window's open and the train is moving. Sometimes the scenery is going to be rough, but we'll help you. Yeah, we'll help explain it along the way, or as best as we can.
And if you'd like to get in touch with Richard and me, reach out to theworld@sky.uk, and we'll try and share your thoughts on the podcast and get back to you.
Yeah, let's take questions sometime. That would be fun.
Thanks, Richard. Really good to see you, and good to see you're safe.
Thank you. Good to see you're safe. And I suspect we'll be together before long. And until next time.
Absolutely.
And you can keep up with Yalda and Richard every single week. Just search for The World with Richard Engel and Yalda Hakim wherever you're listening to this. Before you go, follow your next podcast right here so you don't miss any of our amazing upcoming episodes. And you can find all my recommendations along with news, reviews and loads more on Podcast Rex at www.podcastrex.com. That's www.podcastrex.com.